03-1416 and 1417, John Doe versus the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. And arguing on behalf of John Doe, 67C, is Marcy Hamilton. Ms. Hamilton will be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Jeffrey Anderson of St. Paul, Minnesota, who I assume is a member of Wisconsin Bar. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Anderson, attorney for petitioner John Doe 67F, and I am pleased and honored to introduce to the court Professor Marcy Hamilton, who will argue on behalf of petitioner.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hamilton, you are a member of
the Pennsylvania Bar.
In good standing?
In good standing.
Then we will admit you for purposes of arguing this case until we close the hearing, at which point you will no longer be permitted to argue in the Wisconsin court. Ms. Hamilton, you're the second lawyer from Benjamin Cardoza in a couple of weeks. We saw one of your colleagues, Barry Sheck. Isn't he a member of
He's
your
one
faculty?
Of my college, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You ought to keep in touch with him.
Okay. We're so busy running around the country, we don't know who's where.
Counselor, before you begin, would you put the microphone closer to your mouth? It's kind of out of the way. Thank you very much.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Marcy Hamilton, and I represent John Doe 67F, who is the petitioner in this case. This case comes to this court on a motion to dismiss on the basis of the pleadings, and it is about a child who was sexually abused by a trusted adult, a priest. But it is also about an archdiocese and a church that knew the priest was a predator. But they kept their knowledge secret until 2002, when they were forced by lawsuits and the occurrences in Boston to reveal some of the knowledge that they had. There are two issues before this court. One is the issue of when did my client's claim accrue that arose out of the secrecy? And my answer is it was not before those secrets were revealed in 2002. The second issue is whether the First Amendment can be a bar to this court from applying neutral principles of law that exist to protect children. The answer in these courts' cases since 1995 has been, to that latter question, no. You cannot hear this case. But the time is ripe for reexamination in light of the intervening years. 1995 and 1997 were a very, very long time ago at this point. Under this court's rules, accrual starts at discovery. Unless the legislature has said otherwise, that's when it starts. And there is a manifest injustice under Wisconsin case law, because if my client had asbestos and he had a latent injury, he would be able to bring suit even after the statute of limitations had run on what he knew happened originally.
Counsel, just so I'm clear, are you asking this court to overrule Pritzloff, John Doe, and Clowder?
Yes, Your Honor.
You feel all three of those should be overruled?
Well, Your Honor, if you read those cases together they block the claims that my client is making. If you read them individually, no single case says that a child victim is necessarily barred by the First Amendment. But if you read them together, I think it's inescapable that together they make a barrier that's hard for any victim.
Is there a valid distinction that can be made between an adult victim and a child victim?
Many states have made that distinction, Your Honor, and I think that's a very valid distinction. And it goes to what is the law, the neutral law that's governing. And I would suggest that the law that's governing is whether any reasonable organization that knows that its employees have direct contact with children would pull a pedophile away from those children? That's really the question, and so it really does only go to children.
Now the tort that you're asking us to recognize, first of all, this offense allegedly happened in 1960 to 62.
Yes.
So basically we're looking at 45 years ago.
Yes.
The offender is passed on, I think, 11 years ago.
Yes. The now, perpetrator's died.
Yeah. The question I would have under negligent supervision, which was the Walmart Miller case, which I'm not sure of the year, but I think it was in, I know I was on the court, I was going to say it was 98. Thank you, Justice Crooks. So you're asking us to apply the Miller case to something that happened back in 1960-62, and you're doing it on the basis that at the time your client was, what, 13 or 15?
13.
And that he, was this a repressed memory?
No, it's not repressed memory.
Well, this was only when he recognized that something had happened, but you're saying that the institution, the church, had not.
He had no idea at the time of the abuse, and it was unimaginable at the time that the church would be part and parcel of why he'd been abused. That's the facts that came out in 2002 here and in Boston and other cities that raised this issue of whether or not the statute of limitations must be told until the plaintiff knows.
But, Counselor, don't you have a little problem aside from that? And then in the pleadings, the earliest thing you allege as noticed by the Archdiocese is a 1980 incident, which is many, many years after this abuse. Can you address how you're going to get over that hump for me?
Well, since this is a motion to dismiss on the basis of the pleadings.
Right, and that's what I was referring
yes,
to.
Yes, our argument is that we have evidence from the Archdiocese itself that it knew from 1980 until 2002 about a variety of victims, and that given 22 years of knowledge, that pattern and practice is adequate proof to let us go forward. And
counsel, if I could
follow. But if you're claiming that they failed to supervise them, one of the things you're going to have to show is that they had at least reason to know that this man was dangerous. And if you're not alleging that they knew anything about him until 1980, how do you take that knowledge back to 1962 where you need to put it?
Well, Your Honor, if they only knew about an incident in 1980 by itself, or even 2002 by itself, we wouldn't be here. But we've got 22 years of knowledge about one perpetrator, and we know that these kinds of perpetrators don't improve. And so if later in his career they know that this is what he's been doing, then those years before, it's highly likely that he was also abusing children in those years. So our argument is that the evidence of pattern is there, and that we would like just the opportunity to go forward.
But if I can persist a bit here, his pattern of behavior, I understand from your pleadings and from your brief. What I'm having problems with is the Archdiocese knowledge of that pattern, which knowledge or reason to have knowledge they must have had back in 62. And no matter how much you can show once a perpetrator, always a perpetrator, you can back it up as well as going forward, how do you fit the Archdiocese into that?
The question for our claims is not as much the pattern of the perpetrator, but the pattern of the Archdiocese. We know that the Archdiocese kept this secret willfully for 22 years when it knew about numerous victims. The likelihood that it would have also kept that information secret before is high. And so our argument is that we know enough that they were willing to keep it secret that long. They only came out when they were forced to. So why would anyone assume that just because it was 1980 that all of a sudden they had new information?
But do you can... Just to keep pressing on this point, if you go to trial, would you have to prove, in order to succeed in the claim, that during 1960-62, the Archdiocese knew that this priest was a predator?
At least that it had a reasonable basis to know, yes.
Okay, knew or had a reasonable basis to know. You can't rely solely on the 1980 and subsequent.
No, Your Honor.
You have to pinpoint that.
For the negligence claim.
For the negligence claim.
And your position is... For the fraud and fiduciary duty is different.
Okay. And your position is you want the opportunity to find this evidence. Have you had discovery in this case?
No, we've only made it through to these legal issues.
So you assume that if you can go forward, you're going to have discovery, and your hope is that under those conditions, you are going to find evidence that shows that the Archdiocese was aware of this particular priest's predilections.
Father.
Now, the priest is not being sued.
Yes.
The only lawsuit here is against the Archdiocese.
Yes. And the church.
And the church.
And the individual church.
But not the priest who's deceased.
Right. He's deceased. And this lawsuit would have never happened if the information hadn't come out in 2002. We filed within months of learning all of that information.
Did you even allege in the complaint that the church had knowledge before 1986?
Before 1980, no. No, Your Honor, because...
Well, you didn't even allege...
Well, we allege that they had knowledge of Father Needling's proclivities, but we did not allege any particular date when they would have started or otherwise. So the allegation is there in the complaint that is the basis for what we would do with the discovery request.
What is the allegation of about 1980? That was to the effect that some person saw the priest, but was that the archdiocese that saw the priest? I mean, an official representative.
Well, the archdiocese in 2002, when it was forced to, as part of pressure from victims in litigation, revealed that there had in their files information about Father Needling as far back as 1980. Now, the victims they had, that was relevant. Before 1980, nothing has been released yet. That doesn't mean it's not there.
When did they get the information about 1980?
When
did they get the information about 1980?
It's my understanding that they had it as early as 1980. And our allegations are that as of 1980, they had knowledge that there were abuses occurring.
Who's they? The church?
The church.
Okay.
And the archdiocese.
And when did the plaintiff get knowledge about this priest?
Well, the plaintiff had...
And about the church's knowledge.
Okay.
That's the important question. Right, okay.
Right.
Got it.
Okay, the plaintiff's knowledge occurred in 2002. He had no idea that this record involving Father Needling was there, and it was only when the archdiocese was forced to reveal these issues that he then learned, lo and behold, not only was I abused by a priest, but it was in a circumstance where the church was hiding abuse by priests. And they were moving priests around. And what we have in our allegations is that Father Needling was, in fact, moved around in the classic pattern of the way in which these archdioceses have dealt with pedophiles, unfortunately. And so the pattern is there. He was for limited amounts of time in four different locations, four different parishes, and that pattern is evidence that, in fact, they must have known.
When was the moving between the parishes?
He was moved from parish to parish.
What dates?
Right here. It's on page 8, Your Honor.
Oh. Okay.
The parishes included St. Rita and West Allis from 1948 to 1964.
Now, counsel, just ask, so that's unusual. You're saying that's evidence that is a... significant. I'm going to just say that I'm not a member of the Catholic Church, but in the Lutheran Church, they move, and I belong, pastors in a regular basis around because for various reasons. And
yes, well, we're alleging that that's part of the practice and part of the pattern that's noticeable. But, of course, we're only asking to get beyond the pleadings. We're not saying that all the evidence is already in the pleadings. Only can we get a rule that says he didn't discover this set of defendants until 2002. If we can just get beyond the pleadings, that's the only question that's before this court.
Counsel, would you finish with your answer, please, with regard to page 8 and the changes?
Yes, yes. He was assigned to St. Rita in West Allis from 48 to 64, St. Lawrence in Milwaukee from 1964 to 1967, St. Joseph in Grafton from 1967 to 1968, and St. John the Evangelist in Twin Lakes from 1968 to 1993.
In paragraph 10 of the complaint, on information and belief in approximately 1980, an agent of defendant diocese witnessed needling sexually abusing a boy in the sanctuary at St. John's. Is that Jane Trussell?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that.
Did you get this information out of the newspaper?
The information was gathered both from the lawsuits that were filed and from the newspapers. So, but the information was directed back to the Archdiocese.
Well, it doesn't say when that person came forward and reported it to the Archdiocese.
Well, Your Honor, what we learned is that the Archdiocese had reason to know. The question is not whether the Archdiocese had absolute proof, but whether they had reason to know that he was, in fact, doing inappropriate things with children. And it's our contention that on the basis of the pleadings, that that's an adequate pleading to get us into discovery, that that introduces the issue of whether or not the Archdiocese knew at the time that he was abused that, in fact, he was a pedophile.
Ms. Hamilton, your argument in regard to the statute of limitations and the discovery rule, does that depend on whether or not the court finds that your claim is derivative in nature rather than a direct claim or vice versa?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think the court needs to reach that issue given that the Court of Appeals addressed both and said if it were derivative, it was foreclosed. If it was not derivative, it was foreclosed. It's our view that none of our claims are derivative. They do not arise out of the moment of the sexual attack. They arise out of the secrecy of the Archdiocese, which we only could learn about as of 2002. And so they are independent tort theories against the actions or inactions of the Archdiocese and the Church. They are not derivative on the sexual attack itself.
This case started out with a series of plaintiffs.
I think it was ten.
Right. Now you have one.
Yes.
Does it make any difference that you have one now instead of 10 over a series of times?
Well, Your Honor, the nine that are no longer in the case have taken advantage of the Church's offer to essentially pay for some of the damages in return for not being part of a suit anymore. Our John Doe 67F was not interested in that particular possibility. And so they have made a choice to make an agreement with the Archdiocese, which was their right. But John Doe 67F has a viewpoint that these issues need to be clarified. And so he desired to go forward and did not do that same thing.
Well, I understand that. But the essence of your claim, as I understand it, is that the Church negligently hired or supervised a particular priest in a period in 1960 to 62. I just see nothing in your pleading that shows evidence of that.
Well, Your Honor, the pleadings under the rules are supposed to be taken as true for this stage. And the pleadings certainly indicate that that John Doe 67F was harmed by the fact that the Archdiocese had kept secret, even if it was only from 1980, had kept secret that, in fact, they knew they had a pedophile on their hands. For him, The discovery was that his own church was actually part of what kept him from not understanding what was wrong with his life. I mean, what happens with these child abuse situations is at the time no child can comprehend that this is going to be an overcast on their entire lives. They have no idea. No child has that horizon. And so he's saying, look, I was harmed at the time of the abuse, no question about it. Father Needling should have gone to jail, but that's over. Now my point is that I have been harmed because I had 22 years at a minimum where the archdiocese knew that they were moving priests around, and I had no idea that they were part of this particular practice. And that's a different claim. We are arguing that this is one case on its facts by itself, and that it should be permitted to go forward, just the one case. He should have the opportunity to prove whether or not there was negligent supervision, whether or not there was fraud, and being barred from doing that by the legal conclusions in Pritzloff and Doe is, in our view, fundamentally unfair.
Counsel, initially you indicated that you thought cases would have to be overruled. Why can't, for instance, and you named three cases, why can't LLN, the Clouder case, be distinguished? Your emphasis in that case by the majority was certainly dealing with facts, an adult woman, consensual relationship. Much of the discussion dealt with, at least the First Amendment discussion, dealt with the vow of celibacy. Very different than a alleged criminal act,
right,
that we have here. So why can't it be with a child?
Well, I mean, we'd be delighted to distinguish all three cases. If we could distinguish Pritzloff and Doe, and Clouder would be thrilled. The problem with Clouder is that it goes to the next step and says, even if there's a viable theory in your complaint, the First Amendment stands as a bar to the court investigating it.
That gets to the issue and part of this new legislation, effective May 1, 2004, 895-71, which indeed, however, does allow a cause of action to go forward. You know, I don't know if it's constitutional, if it's at odds with Clouder, or if Clouder is focused on the facts, as I indicated, an adult consensual relationship.
Well, the two free exercise issues and Establishment Clause issues between the statute and between whether the First Amendment bars the court of hearing these things are completely different issues, right? The problem with the statute is that it gives religious entities special treatment. They get special protections in child abuse cases that no other tortfeasor gets, and it is both irrational and arbitrary for the legislature to make that sort of distinction. It's not like it's accommodation where the legislature could say, you have a religious practice, you believe in, we'll take the Native American church, you believe in smoking peyote, we understand it's not a very unsafe drug, we're going to give you the right to do that for religious purposes. This is not accommodation. This is just carving out religious entities for special treatment in tort cases.
Now, that statute doesn't apply to you anyway,
does it? It does not apply on many
theories. It won't
save
you.
No. It won't save us or hurt us. That statute does
not
apply.
It's just not applicable because of the provisions of the statute.
And plus, it can't be applied retroactively unless the legislature was clear, which it wasn't.
Let me ask you, though, about the statute, since that's come up. The statute I find interesting because it seems to be an expression of public policy by the legislature. And the legislature, if I understand correctly, has said up until the age of 35, if you were a child victim, you can go ahead and bring an action. Now, if I'm correct, isn't your client somewhere in his 50s?
Well, he is, but the question is, can the legislature extinguish the discovery rule, which it has done with that provision? Yes, it can, but those provisions don't apply to my client. And so the question is how do you apply the discovery rule to my client? And that is when we get back to Pritzloff.
Well, is it improper for this court to consider the public policy that was declared by the legislature in selecting 35 as the age?
Your Honor, that is beyond the purview of this court. That is a legislative function. The legislature is perfectly within its bounds to choose a time frame. But this court is not a legislature. It's not.
Oh, I recognize that. Don't worry.
Well, that we're in agreement. This court doesn't have that capacity to draw those kinds of lines. The question, the only question this court can address is using its own doctrine of accrual. When does the discovery rule kick in? And on those cases, except for clergy abuse, on those cases, the discovery rule permits the statute of limitations to be told until there's actual factual discovery by the plaintiff.
So you think it would be inappropriate for us to consider the public policy expressed by the legislature in selecting 35 at looking at our court-made discovery rules?
This court is not a policymaker. It decides the cases.
Oh, but we make decisions sometimes where policy enters into the choices being made.
Policy enters in when it's a close question between doctrines or perhaps constitutional issues. But policy cannot be used legitimately, in my view, if the result is to turn back the discovery rule for just a small class of victims. And that's a completely different issue. I do think that courts are required to be unbiased toward the classes of victims and are also supposed to be applying rules in a fair manner. The legislature can be arbitrary, cut it off and say, okay, this group up to 35 years, but that's not the role of this court in my view.
If you're talking about roles, I don't get it. I don't see why you say the legislature can do what they want. We have said in Clouder, if you interpret Clouder the way that you are suggesting that you're hamstrung by it, Clouder said, first we hold that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits LLN's negligent supervision claim. Now, we, the court system, are the final arbiters of the interpretation of the Constitution.
Yes.
How can a legislature enact a policy that is inconsistent with our interpretation of the First Amendment?
Oh, that's a completely different issue. The one question is, can this court use policy to drive the result for discovery rule? The second question is, who trumps in terms of constitutional interpretation? There's no question that this court does, which is why I find Clouder so troubling.
Well, or right. Maybe Clouder isn't quite as pervasive as ties your hands as much as you think it does.
Well, if Clouder...
You can't have it both ways. You can't have the legislature enacting legislation that's contrary to our holding in Clouder. That's a problem. The other side of the coin is maybe our holding isn't as broad as you're suggesting.
Well, with all due respect, I think the legislature got it wrong and the court got it wrong. So, well, I'm against everybody.
That's a very candid answer.
Two wrongs, let's hope we'll make a right here.
That's my hope.
Let me just see if I can summarize so I understand your position. Your position about the statute of limitations is, this is the plaintiff's position, that the cause of action against the Archdiocese for negligent supervision accrued, began to run, mm-hmm. The statute of limitations began to run in 2002.
Yes.
When the plaintiff discovered that the Archdiocese had information about its priests,
yes,
and was hiding it,
yes,
and that has information and hiding and moving the priest constitutes negligence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that you understand you have to bring the negligence into the 1960s, 60
yes.
to 62. And the Archdiocese is going to argue, but that's what we're going to hear, that the cause of action accrued in the 1960s.
Yes.
When the defendant was harmed. The defendant then had reason to know that the priest was under the supervision of the Archdiocese, that this was not appropriate behavior, and therefore that was when the discovery should have been made properly. Therefore, the statute of limitations has run. Those are the arguments.
Those are the arguments. It's Doe BBB,
right,
which sets up that running.
I understand
And the problem is that no child understands the future at the time of the abuse.
Okay. And as to the First Amendment, your position is the case was wrong to say that you cannot look at negligent supervision.
Clearly wrong.
I have one other question. In the Walmart case, the court recognized the tort of negligent supervision. Did we have a case prior to Walmart that said there was no such cause of action?
No, but we had a case that said there might be. But that there's no...
Was this cause of action recognized before Walmart crossed the country?
Oh, absolutely. It's a common law rule that did not need to be either codified or recognized by a court.
Probably in the restatement of torts
at that
time. It is in the
restatement of torts.
Dating back to the 60s.
Yes, early 60s.
Didn't both Clouder and Pritzloff assume that there was such a cause of action?
Yes, right. And then, but they were cut off by the accrual rule, and then in Clouder by the First Amendment. So those were the barriers. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I guess it's still morning. Good morning.
It just seems just like a long time, right.
Because,
John A. Rothstein, Quarles and Brady, representing the Archdiocese.
Thank you
Council.
For the introduction, Your Honor. With me is David Muth, my partner, and together we represent St. Rita's Parish, which is a parish in Milwaukee, together with the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. May it please the Court, the heart of this case is the statute of limitation, so I'd like to get right there. I believe, from the Archdiocese point of view, the determinative factors in this case that the court will have to decide ultimately, in all cases, is public policy. And why do I say that? Because of these unalterable facts. We have claims that were allegedly brought or occurred between 1960 to 62 at age 13 to 15. The age of majority was 21 at the time, and the statute provided one more year, so that would bring it to 1969. The other undisputed fact that I think is dispositive for public policy is that this case was then brought 41 years, four decades after these events occurred, at a time when this individual was 56 years of age. And I will explain why I think the public policy dictates and requires, under statute of limitations, balancing, you have to balance the two interests, why it requires in all cases the affirmance of the lower court's decision. I will also address with you why I believe that the requirements of the discovery rule would compel the same result. But as I said, the policy considerations that this court applies in cases of statute of limitation or an accrual, public policy always plays, to hold that an action of 41 years may be construed as against public policy. Now, in terms of the statute of limitations, I think the issue has become, well, policy. So it's important to make express what are the balancing interests behind the statutes of limitation. What are we concerned about? The legislature as well as this court. I boil them down to two things. On the one hand, it's the desire to protect people, individuals, who may have suffered unjust injuries. That's the first interest. But the equally important interest in the legislature as well as this court is the fundamental fairness of protecting people who have been subject to unjust lawsuits. So it's the balancing of those two that always is the critical issue on all these cases.
How do you tell whether the lawsuit's unjust?
That's precisely what you cannot do, and that's precisely the challenge with statutes of limitation. When an action is started, the court, the judge, nobody knows whether or not this is an instance where it's an unjust injury or a case of an unjust suit. That's why the legislature has to decide what is a reasonable period of time, because we all recognize, the law recognizes, the court recognizes, after a certain period of time, it becomes fundamentally unfair to expect parties to defend this. And this...
That's because most people don't keep records. The witnesses are dead, so it's very hard to defend yourself. Of course, the plaintiff has the same problem. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to find records, witnesses, et cetera, to prove the claim. But here, what's unjust? You've got an institution, could be a corporation, keeps records, long-term records. And so you don't have to worry about staleness in that sense.
Well,
because you do have a deceased priest who can't be a witness.
It's more than that, Your Honor. This is the claim of negligent supervision. The alleged offender, Father Needling, died 11 years ago.
Right.
Think of 11 years of trying to defend that party and what information is available. The supervising, allegedly, the archbishop at the time, that would have been, of course, we're going back 4 decades ago. That would have been at the time that Father Needling was installed and ordained, would have been Archbishop Kiley, 1934 to 1953. He's dead. Between 1953 and 58, during the time this priest was a priest, the next archbishop was Archbishop Meyer. He's dead. The bishop during which these alleged offenses occurred, 1960 to 62, was Archbishop Cousins. He's also dead. The pastor at St. Rita's Parish is now, all the time during which this individual was a priest there. He's also dead. He died in 1966. The unfairness, the fundamental unfairness is this, and then I'd like to speak to the question of law. The fundamental unfairness is this. Think of St. Rita's Parish and who those people are today. Their parish council, their priest, the people who assist in the various educational functions, of course, they have no clue, no information, and yet they will be demanded to defend events that going back 40 years. In my case, I wouldn't have been a teenager at the time. For me to think that I could remember events accurately, but they don't even have the advantage of being the person accused. They have to defend a third party. We're not talking about the wrongdoer. The archdiocese, who has to defend that? Archbishop Timothy Dolan was installed in 2002. And with the mediation program, Justice Prosser asked about this, has been installed. He now has to defend and try to understand, going back 40 years, of what the information was at that time.
Counsel, isn't, and our jurisprudence may be mixed, but you're asking for public policy. Your first argument is public policy to preclude liability. That's what you're asking for. And our jurisprudence, there's several cases that say that public policy to limit liability should not be considered until the case has gone to trial. There are several cases that say that. Those who don't follow, the cases that don't follow that, oftentimes cite that, but then go on to say, for purposes of the application of public policy to limit liability, we will assume negligence. Because whether we assume negligence of the archdiocese, negligent supervision, before we consider public policy limiting liability, or we do what we say in our jurisprudence is the preferred practice, to let it go to trial and only apply limitations of liability after negligence has been established. But either way, we either have to let it go to trial under our jurisprudence or assume negligence. Is that your understanding of our jurisprudence?
No, actually, in these cases, you have cases right on point. The Pritzloff case. The Pritzloff case was the first of these series decided by the Supreme Court, decided on, as you say, Justice Bradley, a motion to dismiss. And the actual holding was, in that case, it was 27 years delay between the time of the alleged abuse and 27 years later, the time when the action was commenced. And here is what the court held on a motion to dismiss. We conclude to allow the claim to proceed against the Archdiocese based on Ms. Prislot's allegations concerning Father Donovan, despite the passage of 27 years since the end of the alleged relationship, would be contrary to public policy of the state. And it repeats saying, sound policy requires that the discovery rule should not save a claim under the facts of this case. The court has stated that the discovery rule will apply only when meritorious claims outweigh the threat of stale or fraudulent action. Extending the discovery rule to this case would cause unfairness to a defendant who is forced to attempt to defend a suit for emotional and psychological injuries in which the alleged conduct took place over 27 years ago and for the potential of fraud.
Well, as I say, our jurisprudence is mixed because we do have cases that indicate, as I suggested, the assessment of negligence necessarily or the assumption of negligence as a precondition to consider public policy limiting liability. I think of the Rockwhite case as kind of a seminal case that puts all of that jurisprudence together.
I would add two things to this, Your Honor. The Pritzloff case was then followed by the Doe cases and also held in public policy on motions to dismiss. And it's particularly important here because we're dealing with allegations, not against the wrongdoer. That would be one thing, and that's a different balance. Here you're dealing, clearly, with parties that claim if there's liability are secondarily liable defendants.
Counsel, what if the claim had been alleged in the complaint that the Archdiocese knew about Father Needling's problems back in 1960 to 62.
In this case, as you know, I wanted to bring up the new statute. The new statute, which was now enacted effective 2004, requires that very element. We believe that for purposes of both liability and constitutional, you'd have to show that actual knowledge or should have known. So your question goes back to, in effect, what does the new statute? And I believe that would have to be shown. And that was another...
But that's under the statute. I'm talking about under the discovery rule. That's the plaintiff asserts that wants the court to apply here. If there had been facts alleged that the Archdiocese was aware of Father Needling's difficulties back in 1960 to 62, so we're not talking about a claim that's solely derivative from what he has done, but talking about what the Archdiocese knew, would you be making the same argument?
No, I wouldn't. But this goes back to what is the record, and Justice Rogensack asked about the actual knowledge. When this case was presented, and Justice Prosser also pointed this out, there were 10 cases originally. 9 were settled. This is one case and has to be decided on these facts, of course. There was a motion to dismiss. And obviously, the trial judge at that time, Judge Gooley, made a specific quest of the plaintiff, tell me what is the knowledge that you believe shows the information against the church. And I refer the court's attention to the record. It's in our appendix at page 1. But here is what was said. And I apologize, I have to quote it, but it's at page... It would be page 17 of the respondent's appendix, and it's the trial court transcript. And this is Mr. Anderson, who's here today. And I'm quoting, "And so the statute begins to run when the victims discovered both the negligence or the fraud. And that occurred, Your Honor, this last year when the Archdiocese, for the first time through its bishop, stated publicly and on the record that they knew that Needling was a child molester, that they had known for years and that they had not made that disclosure until last year." Continuing on page 37, "Thus the statute in a fraud action begins to run from the time the fraud is first discovered. And when do they first discover the fraud? Last year when it was made known for the first time, at least to them, as far as we know, to anybody else beside the officials of the church, that they had known that Needling was a molester, unfit by reason of it, and that they had received reports about him in the past for over 2 decades. Now remember, this action was brought in 1993. 2 decades brings you back to, at the latest, would be the 1980s, 1983. And here's what Judge Gooley, accepting at face value the statements made of record by the plaintiff's counsel, he ruled this. The court, this is page 51. "All right. This court wanted to give an oral decision in this case today rather than have the parties wait for the court to issue a written decision. And on page 53, the dispositive one, the plaintiff, although it is not entirely clear in their pleadings or in their brief, has made an argument today attempting to distinguish this case from the previous rulings of the Supreme Court, the Doe case and the Pritzloff case, by stating in their argument that a bishop stated that in the 1980s the church knew of the priest's propensity for abuse and did not reveal it." So it's their best information, accepting at face value the admission of record, is that they say that what saves them is that they have evidence goes back to the 1980s. Now, maybe there's a plaintiff among those 10 where that would be significant, and that would be okay, because if there was an attack after 1980, that would be sufficient. But taking them at their face value.
Read the next part of that.
Thus, the church committed fraud.
Well, but that when we read the, this is the judge talking. When we read, I'm on page 53. Mm-hmm. That's where you are, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
53?
Page 53 of the appendix.
But when we read the earlier cases, particularly Doe, the court stated, in light of our conclusion that all 7 claims were based on intentional assault barred by the applicable statute, we need not address the claims based on respondeat superior and negligent employment theories. Plaintiff's derivative causes of action against the Archdiocese and the churches accrued at the same time that the underlying intentional tort accrued and similarly would be barred by the statute of limitations. That's the issue before us today. The trial court said no, or said we're sucking it all back and we're not doing discovery, and then goes on that. But that's what the issue is today, whether the trial court was right.
I simply only brought it up to demonstrate, of record, the evidence that they suggest would substantiate a claim of a matter of fact, going back to the 1980s, does not justify a claim against the Archdiocese for this reason.
Well, let me ask you this question. Suppose there was an allegation in this complaint that said, on information and belief, as of 1960, the Archdiocese and the church knew or had reason to know that this priest was a predator of children, a sexual predator of children, and did not remove the priest from having contact with children. Would that claim be good in your opinion?
No.
No, that's what I thought, so it's irrelevant.
And the reason,
why
the reason
not?
Is mm-hmm. public policy would strike it in all cases. The issue came up about the statute of limitations and what the legislature has done. And I view it this, it's not binding on this court, of course not, but it does represent the legislature had to balance the very interests that we're talking about. And it is at least relevant for the court to consider that. In terms of childhood abuse. It's now chapter 985.71 followed by 983.587 is the statute of limitation. The legislature, of course, it was lobbied heavily and had to consider all the competing interests of the two I just identified on both the unjust injuries and unjust lawsuits, determined that it would be till age 35, 17 years after majority, that any claim could be brought henceforth. And that it also included, importantly, claims not only against the wrongdoer, but claims against any supervisory organization that fit the statute. So that's what the legislature has said, till the age of 35. This claimant, well, let me, one other additional fact. The legislature has also now said that for criminal actions, now we're going after the wrongdoer, this has no longer any application with respect to the church, respect to synagogues, the wrongdoer, the legislature has now enacted that it would allow to age 45 to bring criminal actions. In this case, if this court were to permit this as a matter of law, it would be allowing a case to be brought at the age of 56 against not the wrongdoer, but against now a supervisory organization under circumstances where the court, I think, correctly held, and it's a matter of stare decisis now, in the Pritzlaff case, after 27 years of delay, that would be inexorably prejudicial to the defendants. And clearly, in terms of the public policy here, in terms of preventing fraudulent claims, basic fairness to the defendants. And remember who the defendants are. It is not the wrongdoer. It is now the successor 4 years later.
Well, hold it. A negligent supervision. I mean, I understand your argument is the priest here is the real perpetrator. But under a negligent supervision, it is the alleged that the Archdiocese is the wrongdoer, or under the fraud cause of action, it is alleged that the Archdiocese is the wrongdoer. Am I missing something?
You've hit it on the head, Your Honor, and that leads to this answer. Now, I've given you the public policy, which...
Before you get to the public policy, I have a question that's bothering me, and finish on the public policy. It's this. It goes back to the sufficiency of the pleadings.
Yes.
Because... what bothered me when I was coming out here is the allegations in the pleading about when did the archdiocese know? And there's an allegation about the event that they had actual knowledge in, pick a couple of dates. One would be maybe someone had actual knowledge in 1980, and then in 1986 it was reported, in 1987. But, of course, that deals with actual knowledge. And it isn't just actual knowledge. There can be a cause of action, much like the current legislation discusses, if you knew or should have known. So it isn't just actual knowledge. We're dealing with knew or should have known. And I look at the complaint, and I see the allegation in paragraph 6 that information and belief during the years 59 to 64, while serving at St. Rita's, at least four boys were abused. Paragraph 7, an information and belief between 68 and 1980, another at least nine boys were abused. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 8 talks about the priest would socialize and bring the kids to his house. And then paragraph 9, on information and belief, defendants knew or should have known of his problems with alcohol and his tendency and history of abusing children. I mean, it seems to me that a read, not the only read, but a reasonable read of this complaint is, look, in for a couple of years, from 59 to 64, we know of at least four kids that were abused. Another period of time, there were at least nine kids. With these kinds of numbers, either they knew or they should have known. That's my read of paragraphs 6, 7, 8, 9. Seems to me that you are reading out they should have known and only dealing with the alleged actual recordings of actual knowledge.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I believe that because the should have known standard is applicable to the archdiocese, but that runs precisely into the discovery rule. What do I mean by this? First of all, I want to address all the issues that you've raised. One, the question is, obviously, as a matter of record, assertions were made both in the briefs. The briefs said in May of 2002. Where does that come from? It comes right, and they refer to those references I gave. They also talk about the Boston scandal. That's, of course, outside the record, but that's what they allege. But the court has to take that as a given. So,
why is this insufficient pleading, giving those 13 kids in those 10 years, and then saying, hey, they either knew or they should have known all of this was going on if it was that rampant?
Especially when the rule is liberal pleadings in favor of the pleader.
I guess the best response is this, Your Honor. I believe that the should have known under the new statute, I just take it from that, but would apply and must apply to the cause of action against the archdiocese. You're going to have to show either knowledge or should have known. But
common law, too, isn't
yeah.
it?
Mm-hmm. Now, but importantly, the know or should have known of a claim of due diligence applies equally with the same vigor to the plaintiff. And I believe as a matter of law, the plaintiff in this case is charged as a matter of law. Why do I say that? Because the claim, there are only two arguments that are made as to why this was deferred to 2002. One, because they didn't know that there was a cause of action for negligent supervision until the Miller case. That occurred in 1998. And number two, they say, we didn't have the evidence to prove that the archdiocese knew until 2002. Let me address both of those under what you're talking about, knew or should have known. The knew or should have known, as a matter of law, to suggest that I didn't know the law and that defers the statute of limitations is contrary to this court's ruling. And at the time, in 1992, there were seven cases in Doe. One case was brought, knew or should have known, in 1992. Four cases were brought in 1993. Two cases were brought in 1994. 1995 was the Pritzloff decision. 1997 was the Doe decision. 1997 was the Clowder decision. 1997 was the John W. decision. For any lawyer in the state to suggest that they didn't know or would not be charged as a matter of law with knowing is that this would be a potential cause of action against the Archdiocese, I don't think can be sustained as a matter of law.
I don't think that's the issue. As I understand the pleadings, the issue here is that plaintiff would not have known that the church would have covered this up. And that comes from paragraph 16. Plaintiff John Doe, 67F, was raised in a devout Roman Catholic family, regularly celebrated Mass, received the sacraments, and participated in church-related activities. Plaintiff John Doe, 67F, therefore developed great admiration, trust, reverence, and respect for the church and its agents. Therefore, would not have expected that a protector would not have taken action. That's what the core of this complaint is, that one did not expect that. Therefore, one did not think one had a cause of action against your client. And it's only when this plaintiff found out, whether you accept this or not, in 2002, that the church did know and didn't reveal that he thinks he has a cause of action. I mean, we don't have to accept that as a cause of action, but I think that's what the complaint is. How do you respond to that?
I respond that, of course, in all complaints, the court must accept, all courts, well-pleaded facts. The court does not have to accept conclusions or inferences, and it is always a question of law for this court as whether an inference can be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this case, what they're alleging is that, and I believe the very question that the court is raising was addressed in the Doe decision
mm-hmm.
in this regard. First of all, we're talking about an individual about at the age of 13 and 15, and maybe there would be a cause of action for fiduciary duty against the individual at the time because of the relationship. You have a different question about the next higher-up organization and even a different question. But once they reach age 21, they get married, they go off to war, they come back. In the 20s, they have children. In the 30s, they're developing their responsibilities. In their 40s, they're now having their own children married. To suggest that that sort of relationship continues and that there is no obligation to conduct due diligence on your own, that's not an inference I think can be drawn at age 56. And it comes back to what Justice Prosser had mentioned. We had 10 cases. Maybe there were cases after 1980 that this would be fined for, but not for this back to 1962. And I wanted to respond. This is what Doe said, and it essentially comes down to this. Even alleging...
Age are you at?
It's Doe, 211 West 2nd at 350.
Okay, got it.
And it held this, is that the plaintiffs, the same plaintiff, as a matter of fact, Mr. Anderson, represented by Mr. Anderson, attempted to use fiduciary duties, as the court was just indicating, to get around. And here's what the Doe case held. We cannot equate the sexual assaults alleged here to allegations of incest. I'll stop there, because there they wanted to say, gee, incest has no statute of limitations effectively, so therefore apply it to non-incestuate.
That was under the statute.
Right. And so it reads on, this is so despite the plaintiff's claims that they either failed to report the assaults or did not recognize the wrongfulness of the assaults because the plaintiffs held great admiration, trust, reverence, and respect for Catholic priests. And here's the key. Trust and confidence should not devolve into blind faith and exempt the plaintiff from the duty of diligently to pursue potential claims. And again, I come back. What did the plaintiffs have? The plaintiffs had what every other lawyer in this state, all the way from single plaintiff law firms like Bob Sosny's firm, who handled them, all the way up to law firms such as Sinekin and LaFollette in Madison, or the Hausman firm in Milwaukee.
Aren't the churches... teachings all premised upon the idea of blind faith?
Well, I couldn't comment upon that.
That's ecclesiastical.
I mean, you threw it out there. I couldn't let it go.
I'd have to get a canon lawyer to answer that one.
It's true.
Counsel, I do have a question, though. You argued public policy, and I don't disagree with the arguments that you advanced regarding public policies. But don't we have competing public policies here, because don't we have a public policy against or to protect children against sexual predators? I mean, don't we have to weigh both?
Of course.
And how do we come down with an answer that deals with both the aspects of dealing with stale claims versus the aspects of protecting children against sexual predators?
I believe that one thing, it's a very tough policy decision. That's why I mentioned, and it, I think it is significant, that the legislature has determined that up till 17 additional years to age 35, it is permissible for civil causes of action. I think it's appropriate that this court not take judicial notice. I mean, it is the court's own decision. It's binding. There's been no arguments that this is not a binding decision or it should be overturned in the briefs. Pritzlaff. Pritzlaff held as a matter of public policy to delay an action against the wrongdoer for 27 years is against public policy. Finally, against criminal statutes. The criminal statutes against the actual wrongdoers is up to age 45. In contrast, this case was brought 41 years later at a time when the gentleman was 56 years of age. Now, and I put this question. If this case, and this was put, this is just one case. If this case is permitted to proceed, there is no statute of limitation because every single plaintiff could simply by the ease of the pen say that I didn't know about, I was out of the country at the time of the Boston scandal. I didn't read those cases back in the 1995s. I didn't know, and that's sufficient to avoid summary judgment. And so there would be effectively, there would be no statute of limitations. This is 41 years. What would be the principal decision at 51 years, 61 years, 71 years? And I again say that in terms of the parties who are being, you have to look at the balancing of interest. St. Rita's, again, or the Archdiocese. These are not, the people at St. Rita's today, they will have no clue 41 years with the normal, take judicial notice of how soon people move. The mix of those people having any clue of any information about a Father Needling or the pastor at that time is zilch. The ability of those people to defend this case or the archdiocese is zilch. The fundamental unfairness is overpowering.
But let's flip the coin. How is the plaintiff going to meet the burden of proof? I mean, well, just judging from your own argument, if no one has any recollection, if there's no institutional recollection, how is the plaintiff going to meet the burden of proof?
Well, that gets to the point, but I think this is like all First Amendment rights in this case. We've been talking about First Amendment in terms of the religious. Okay. But there's other First Amendment rights, and that's the freedom of the press. And there you have also the intersection of tort versus freedom of the press. But to protect and to forestall chilling of First Amendment rights, the Supreme Court, as well as I believe this court, has encouraged, because of the protection of First Amendment, that the liberal use of summary judgments, motions to dismiss, and the pleadings to avoid the very chilling, because if you could simply threaten a defendant that you're always going to be subject to lawsuits, you can't avoid it, you have to go through discovery and the risk of summary judgment, there would be no statute. Thank you.
Well, then, do you think that the statute is unconstitutional, or do you think the statute overturns our cases that say the First Amendment forestalls the court examining the supervision of priests?
Chief Justice, the new statute?
Yes.
No, I don't believe it's unconstitutional. It's not before the court in this case. But, and do I believe that it's unconstitutional?
Well, I'll put it differently.
I don't.
Think it would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment if the court held your client liable? Or I don't mean liable, but to go forward with this case?
There would have, in this case, because of the particular record, it comes back to Justice Prosser's comment, because of the facts that are of record of this case, yeah, it would be. To hold a church liable without of drawing an inference of knowledge 20 years after the fact, that that's a reasonable inference that therefore you can sue 20 years earlier. I think that that would maybe deprivation of due process, things like that.
First Amendment.
First Amendment.
That was the question.
I also believe there may be issues in that, and I'll tell you why. Here's the reason. I come back to the First Amendment with the press. What did the Supreme Court do there? The Supreme Court said that for libel, for instance, if you sue the people protected by the press, it is an elevated standard. It has to be an elevated standard, actual malice, with additional protections of clear and convincing evidence of, for instance, the encouragement of motions to dismiss, etc. For the very same reasons here, to allow...
What Pritzlaff or Clouder said. They didn't say that. They said First Amendment out.
First Amendment,
you can't sue the church.
For
negligent supervision. This is not higher standard. This is absolute bar.
I don't mean to quibble, but I believe if you read that case closely and Clouder, they both say that it doesn't mean that claims cannot be brought against the church and be barred by the statute of limitations. In those, both those cases, if you read those, they were alleging, and this is important, they were alleging in those cases, here, I'll get it.
Look at page 678. First, we hold that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits negligent supervision claim.
Mm-hmm.
Clouder.
L.L.N. Is this Clouder?
Clouder, yeah. Paragraph 2, page 678.
Okay.
This is Pritzloff. Since we conclude that Pritzloff's claim is time-barred, we could end our analysis at this point. However, the question of whether a religious governing body is liable for negligence in hiring, retaining, training, or supervising their employees, clergymen, who commit acts which are outside the scope of their employment is a matter of great public interest. And then they go on, I think, to say here that even if it weren't time barred, it would fail to state a claim. No such causes of action exists, even if it did exist. That the First Amendment, this is on 790, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prevents the court of this state from determining what makes one competent to serve a Catholic priest, etc. Now, that may... goes on for a great length about negligence and the First Amendment. What part do you like?
Thank you. Going in the order presented in the Clouder case, if you take a look at footnote 18, which was by Justice Crooks, I believe, it said, it was very carefully worded, that this decision should not be interpreted to mean that a court can never determine whether a cleric is an agent or employee of a religious organization, etc., acting within the scope. So, he makes...
Well, that's if suppose he's driving a car. I mean, I'm sure that wouldn't be covered by the First Amendment. Right.
Similarly, I wanted to address the Pritzloff case. There, of course, that was a different allegation. The allegations, among others, that the court had to address in terms of First Amendment was a claim by the plaintiff that the archdiocese had negligently counseled and guided priests in dealing with issues of celibacy. Well, of course, that is a First Amendment, and that was appropriately ruled. But I want to conclude on this in terms of the First Amendment. This does not raise to a First Amendment case. I say that because the statute of limitations is dispositive of this action. Addressing First Amendment would be purely academic or advisory only. And it's also, secondarily, because of the effectiveness of the new statute, the prospective effect would be zero. Because as we sit here now, the new statute is now in effect that can be brought. And with respect to that, the court would have to address the First Amendment rights in that statute with parties who are under that statute arguing the case. Of course, we don't have that. So First Amendment issues are not, it doesn't raise because of the statute of limitations issue. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Rothstein. Ms. Hamilton, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Well, let me work backwards. Just to take the First Amendment speech clause off the table, we're not talking about speech. Belief is 100% protected. Government can't tell you to believe anything. Speech is highly protected, but it's not 100% protected. Conduct is not highly protected. Why? Because conduct hurts other people. And so the government is capable of regulating conduct even when it's religious. And that has been the rule at the Supreme Court since the first free exercise case. Now, so the speech issue is a red herring. The discussion about what evidence that we would be able to put forward has missed a crucial element. No employer has no files involving their employees. I don't know an archdiocese in the country that does not have two kinds of files. Employee files that cover every employee they've ever had, and secret archives. Now, we know about these in a number of jurisdictions because they have been released. That information does not require anyone to be present to prove that in their files they had evidence that Father Needling was, in fact, abusing kids. Now, we've alleged, as was read earlier, that there's evidence back to 1959 that he had multiple victims. The allegations have to be sufficient. If Doe and Pritzloff's reading of the discovery rule can be gotten around, right? What that says is that discovery rule as a matter of law ends the entire
situation. But sufficient against whom? Sufficient against Father Needling or sufficient against the Archdiocese?
No, sufficient against the Archdiocese, because what the files show is what the Archdiocese knows. Right? Whatever's in the files of the Archdiocese, we can presume the Archdiocese knows, right?
No, no, but your argument was that we know that there were allegations back to 1959. What we don't know is whether the Archdiocese had knowledge of whether there were allegations within their possession that go back to 1959.
But the likelihood you have that many victims and that many moves together make it highly unlikely the Archdiocese didn't know. And we are not asking this court to hold that we win. We're just asking, do we get beyond the pleadings to do discovery? And there is certainly adequate information about employment in the files of the Archdiocese to justify our going forward and proving that the Archdiocese knew. I mean, we'll be the first. Yeah, go ahead.
How far would you go back? Suppose someone came and said, I was molested by the father in 1951. Go back to that one, too?
Well, Your Honor,